Hello and welcome to Talking Therapies, a podcast made together with Psychologies Magazine and the UK Council for Psychotherapy, or the UKCP for short. I'm Susie Walker and I'm the Editor-in-Chief at Psychologies. Each month on Talking Therapies, we'll be talking to a UKCP therapist about a range of topics. In this episode, we will be discussing wellness in the workplace. If you're a workaholic or you're finding that work is getting you down, then this is the podcast for you.
You might want to think about having some sort of ritual. So when you get home, is it having a bath? Is it changing your clothes? Is it having a cup of tea? Maybe meditating could be different for everybody, but there's a real power in having some sort of ritual that marks the transition between work and home. It helps to create emotional space.
That was psychotherapist Jared Green. Jared works across a range of issues and often supports clients who have experienced workplace issues. Previously, Jared worked internationally for e-commerce and retail companies. He now offers toxic workplace training to help other therapists support clients through workplace toxicity. Shortly, Jared will be talking to Martin Podikoff, the chair of UKCP, about how we can all improve our own work-life balance. But first, here's some comments about workplace wellness from people we spoke to on the street.
Well, yes, I have been a workaholic before, and it didn't take much to get out of it, just a little bit of effort, and that someone actually probably needs to tell you to your face that your work can go on without you.
I feel like I'm the complete opposite of a workaholic. I'll take on the least work as amount as possible, just to ensure that I'm not tired.
The culture is expected that you work long hours, and there's no real consideration for how you manage those hours and yourself. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't feel like I have enough time to relax and wind down, but when I do, I normally travel if I can, but more day-to-day is just, you know, sort of switching the brain off, catching up on some TV, listening to a podcast, and just kind of hanging out with friends and family. Mental health and wellness needs to be sort of like a part of the culture of the company from day one, and that just as much as you want to make sure that your employee's productive, you want to make sure that they're happy and that they're just sort of, you know, they feel right in and of themselves.
According to the Centre for mental health problems at work cost the UK economy £34.9 billion last year. Whilst the Mental Health Foundation say improving workplace wellness increases productivity to as much as 12%. So let's find out some more about workplace wellness.
But Jared, how can we aspire to achieve without feeling that we're not quite up to it, we're faking?
Faking, okay, I like that question.
Okay.
It's a good question. I guess I want to respond to it by asking a question about the individual. The question is, who's not quite up to it? Whose version of not quite up to it? So if we can sort of take a step back to how we make decisions, our minds are very good at being efficient with energy. So many of the decisions we make in a daily basis are actually based on previous decisions, on habits, maybe on assumptions we've made. And often the idea of not quite being up to it is a reckoning that happens instantaneously, that happens automatically, without as much objectivity as we think.
So we're given a task, we think, oh my God, I won't be able to do that.
Right. And that will happen without much cognition. It would sort of be an automatic thought, potentially.
Mm.
It can be.
But the feelings will be there.
The feeling, absolutely. And that's key. That's often, in from my perspective, what's driving those thoughts. And I think it's especially true at work. If you look at the big picture of work, it's about career, right? It's about career path, where you've come from, where you're going to.
Mm.
And so in therapy, we might find under the surface that the decisions that have been made about career are somewhat automatic, or maybe less rational than we might think.
Mm-hmm.
They might be influenced by mum and dad. They might have been driven, say, by peers, by wanting to keep up with peers. They might have been driven by wanting to avoid risk, wanting to aspire towards wealth, for example. So, you know, as you can see, these are decisions that may have been made not in the truest interest of who I really, really am,
mm-hmm.
but in some sort of conforming with culture, with society, with others.
So in your work, you're looking at the underlying issues here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Trying to unpack it. What is it about my background that impacts my ability to tolerate the workplace, or perhaps impacts the way I've got here and whether I'm in the right place in my life? So I think on a more granular level, on a day-to-day level, that I'm not good enough feeling is actually possibly about feeling less than perfect, not feeling that you're up to it because you have a general sense of not being good enough, rather than anything to do with a particular task. And so we kind of, in therapy, we might ask the question, is this real or is this something that you're creating?
But by real, I mean it is really a stress-producing issue, which
exactly.
shouldn't be there. If you write about toxic workplaces, what do you mean about that
term? Okay, well, I mean, background, I've done some writing and my clinical practice involves a lot of encounters, I guess, with toxic workplaces. And in my previous career, before becoming a therapist, I actually worked in e-commerce, in retail, in corporate organisations, and also in agencies. So I had a lot of exposure to a lot of different workplaces. And I've seen a bit of toxicity firsthand along the way. Mm-hmm. So that very much informs my perspective. But there's also a formal definition of toxic workplaces that comes from, say, organisational behaviour. To explain it, it's helpful to look at the phrase psychological contract. And this might sound a bit abstract at first, but a psychological contract is the interpersonal understanding that is created between the employer and the employee as they come into a workplace. So some of that is based on the contract, the actual hard and fast documentation of what your job's going to be, but it's mostly based and more powerfully based on the idiosyncrasies, the conversation that you have with the person giving the interview, with your first line manager. They all set up a kind of unwritten contract, which is totally subjective. It's based on interpersonal communication. And so we can think of a toxic workplace as a workplace which in some way disrupts that psychological contract. It doesn't turn out to be the way it was supposed to be. And that can be emotional, or it can be practical, or it can be a combination of both.
What are the signs that your workplace might be toxic?
Well, okay, in my experience, this kind of falls into two categories. There are workplaces that sort of have some sort of structural toxicity. You know, maybe the culture is driven by people who are very much about commercial success and have very little regard for interpersonal issues or employee well-being. And that can be quite common in commercial organisations. It may even be that there are toxic practices, so that there's deliberate attempts to create pockets of toxicity in some of these organisations. Or it might just be that the competitive kind of groupthink around performance leads to some sort of toxic situation. So they're kind of that's the kind of structural level.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a more local level of toxicity where the organisation overall might be pretty balanced and there might be a focus on well-being, but there are individual managers, individual employees who, through their personality or through their actions, somehow create smaller pockets of toxicity.
Okay.
So they're the kind of levels you might see. And I think the thing to say about the first point, the kind of the organisations that are structurally toxic, is that quite often in our culture, people have signed up to work at them. And they're happy to do so because they're getting the bonus and the salary package.
Sure.
They're willing to make that sacrifice for the pound of flesh. And so I'm not criticising that. I don't really have an opinion on that. That's a personal decision. Mm. But where I am interested is where a workplace develops that kind of structural toxicity, but it was never explained to the employee. The employee never knew it was going to be that way. It was kind of, it transformed at some point, or it was actually hidden.
So if you, let's say, sign up and become a trader in a city, you know how bad it's going to be,
you
right?
probably but do
you know that going in, so you've made that contract.
conscious decision, right? Exactly.
But if that suddenly turns up because you've got a new manager who's a bully or something,
exactly,
that becomes problematic.
And often, you know, in a workplace context, people you know, don't feel they can move easily. They don't feel that their livelihood can sustain them if they were just to sort of not go anymore. So there can be a sense of trappedness. There can be a lot of very powerful feelings.
And that sense of trappedness, do you think that's realistic?
I think it's very real to the individual at that point in time. And I think, you know, there's a lot of powerful early life kind of connections here. It's about nurture. It's about being safe. And this is what the workplace provides. So yeah, we do attach. We do attach to the workplace. That said, we can also unattach. We can work through what our dependence is and move forward.
Would you know before you sign up for a job that that's liable to be toxic, that place?
I think that's a really good question. And I think sometimes, yes, there can be telltale signs. And some of them are the trading example that you had the example of. There are also, I think, some signs that you can pick up on by doing a bit of homework. And I think some of them relate to business strategy. So if you know, for example, the business has just had a new change of ownership, it's got a new management structure, it's operating in a environment that is very much changing, well then, hey, the organisation's going to have to change, and part of what management might be looking at are the people and the practices around people, and they might need to make some changes. You might also find that there are cues that you pick up in an interview process. And you might start to get an intuition. This doesn't feel quite right. And I encourage people to listen to that. That a feeling or an intuition about a workplace, especially from the people you're meeting with when they're sort of selling you the role, that's really important information. On its own, intuition and feeling, you know, you might not want to make the decision entirely based on intuition and feeling, but some of those signals might tell you, I need to do a bit more homework. And I think this is important because we at the end of the day, are the only people who will care about ourselves enough in a workplace. The organisation is never going to take as much responsibility for our personal well-being as we are. So take personal responsibility, do some homework. I think doing some background research on a company is very helpful, looking at the press. There's some websites like, I mean, you might have heard of Glassdoor. It's a website of employee reviews. Now, like any review website, take it with a grain of salt because there can be some bitterness in there as well. But it is a useful way to get another perspective. And, you know, if you're getting any of these warning signs, then do a bit more homework. Track someone down who works there. Go onto LinkedIn and see who you know who knows someone. Talk to a mentor or a previous manager, someone who can give you a bit of insight. So, yeah, I guess in summary, you can tell. Sometimes, though, it changes, so you'll have no idea that workplace might be like that. Mm. But do your homework.
One of the things is people always say, well, I was, you know, so-and-so till I was about 40, and then I just thought, what the fuck am I doing here? And I decided to go and become a teacher, or they did something else.
Or a therapist.
At 9/11, people just, especially in the States, just jacked things in and went and did other stuff. And found jobs that really suited them. There is a midlife crisis, and that's normally finding yourself at the top of the ladder and realizing it's against the wrong wall. Right? That's because you think, well, why would I feel, you know, I've got all these things, I've got the title, why do I feel like this? And I think that's where a therapist comes in, really helpful when you have those ideas.
It's really interesting to hear you say that. In fact, in many ways, you're talking about my life story.
Right,
okay. When I got to my mid-30s, I was like, I'm against the wrong wall here. This isn't quite working. And I think that's the real upside to having a workplace crisis.
Right.
Is that often it's a call to go deeply within and figure out, what do I really want? And has the last 20, 30 years of career been delivering against a sense of meaning? And I find once you've kind of got a lot of the anxiety out of the way, when you've helped the client separate from their workplace situation, it's then that the deeper questions, existential kind of questions, start to emerge. Mm. What do I want out of my life? Do I want to make money, or do I want to help people? Mm. Am I about creativity? The questions that maybe didn't get asked sooner can start to come to the fore.
And can I do both? Can I make money and
help
people?
Absolutely.
Which is... Yeah. Quite possible.
Yeah. And or can I be creative alongside my next job? Can I make sure there's enough balance to have guitar lessons? I don't know. You know, it's often a wake-up call to what we really want in life.
I was really Terry Winter, who wrote The Sopranos. I was the script editor of The Sopranos and wrote Boardwalk Empire. Big writings. He was a lawyer till he was about 29.
All
and
right,
he always wanted to do this. And he said, okay, if I don't do this now, I'll never do it. I'm just changed. You know?
Yeah.
And it worked.
It seems like it did for him.
It did work for him, yeah.
Yeah, I think it happens a lot with creative people.
But you did that. Mm. You changed. I've done that. Jared, if I suspect I'm suffering from work-related stress, what should I do?
Okay, well, this can be really tough. And, you know, we touched on this before when we were having a chat, but when we're in this kind of situation, there can be a lot of very powerful feelings going around. It can feel anxious. It can feel hopeless. There can be fear. So the first thing I'd say is this can be really difficult for people. And because of the sense of dependence that we often develop with our workplace, it can be really, really powerful stuff. It can be, you know, people can feel quite debilitated by this feeling. And there's something that I think is a little bit abstract, but I think is really important here. And it's one of the first things that I try and work with a client who's come to me in this sort of situation. And it's about separateness. And the statement that I use around this is to say something to the person like, you are not your job. So it's an important kind of statement, because it if you think about going to a party or a social context in our culture, often the first question that gets asked is, what do you do? And I think about it like, well, okay, I'm Jared and I'm a therapist at the moment. I'm earning money from it at the moment. It's my profession. And that's quite different to saying, I'm Jared, I'm a therapist. If you see what I mean. Jobs are transitionary. We move, we change. But in our culture, we get so caught up in the fact that we have this job. And so the attack on the job, as it were, the sense that the job might be under threat, becomes an attack on us.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, how can we separate from that? And that's something that therapy is really good at helping with. It's very hard to kind of work through a struggle like that on your own. But go to the right therapist and you're going to find there's an ability to work through that with them.
Would you say go and see HR? Would you recommend that?
Well, I think there's a misconception that HR is full of people who support people. And I think that's not true.
Right.
I think HR is about managing the resources of a company.
And managing people out.
Quite often.
Right.
Mm. So there's a huge risk with talking to people at the workplace. If you do need some support from someone who you really, really trust, be careful. How do you know? And it might make more sense to speak to a therapist or a friend who's outside of the organisation. But a therapist in particular isn't going to find you overwhelming. A therapist isn't going to find that you're too much. A therapist is going to be objective and is going to have the skills to be able to help you.
Mm.
So it's very different to talking to a friend.
Do you have any advice on how to leave work at work? Because we're always seem to be linked to it 24/7.
Well, that's a really good point too. The technology, it just sort of keeps us connected, doesn't it?
Mm.
And yeah, I think that's one of the key points. I mean, it's a very therapeutic word and I tend to say it a lot, but it's about boundaries. It's about how do you define your boundaries? When am I at work? When am I at home? So on the technology point that you mentioned, well, do you need to have a technology detox every day, every week? Do you need to turn off your work emails when you after 9 o'clock or after you leave the office? You know, what is right for you?
Mm.
And when I say what's right for you, it's like, well, what is right for your work situation and your personal needs? So if your work-life balance is taking up all the time that you could use to exercise, to relax, to socialize, then maybe your work-life balance is out of whack and the boundary needs to be pulled in. So the boundaries I'm talking about, the obvious one, how many hours a day do you spend at the office? When do you go home? How much time do you spend at lunch break? Do you leave the office during a lunch break? These might seem like inconsequential things, but over the course of a week, they really add up to give you a lot of emotional space or not. And then similarly, I think, and this is something I think that as therapists, we get trained very much to take care of ourselves and to learn to leave work at work. And you might want to think about having some sort of ritual. So when you get home, is it having a bath? Is it changing your clothes? Is it having a cup of tea? Maybe meditating could be different for everybody, but there's a real power in having some sort of ritual that marks the transition between work and home. It helps to create emotional space.
Brilliant. Well, Gareth, thank you.
That was psychotherapist Jared Green speaking with Martin Polakoff, the chair of the UK Council for Psychotherapy. If, after listening to that, you feel you could benefit from taking some time with a psychotherapist, then go to Find a Therapist section of the UKCP website and have a look through. The website address is www.psychotherapy.org.uk and look for the Find a Therapist tab. We're also featuring the subject of workplace wellness in the Psychologies magazine this month, or you can find us online, psychologies.co.uk. We'll be doing a podcast each month for the next year with some of the UKCP psychotherapists. And remember to like and subscribe to our channel to hear it first, and it will help others to find us too. Join us again next month. Till then, thank you so much for listening and take good care of yourselves.